Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you listening. Back in January, China demonstrated its ability to hit an object orbiting the Earth as it used a missile to destroy an aging satellite, becoming only the third nation after the United States and Russia to demonstrate that it could do such a thing. Although China has said that it has no intention to develop space weapons, this test led some people once again to predict the beginning of a new arms race in space. Now, this is a subject that hasn't really been in the media very much, at least until that point it hadn't been, although it did get some attention last fall when the Bush administration announced a new space policy, the first time that the country's space policy had been updated since 1996 and in the Clinton administration. It's something, though, that people in defense circles had been talking about, continue to talk about for a long time, because there are those who do indeed believe that someday there will be military conflict in space, and that the United States ought to be ready to have control over space, or at least do so before anyone else does. We'll be talking this morning about American space policy, and our guest for the show is Mike Moore. He is currently a research fellow with the Independent Institute. That's a libertarian think tank. He's the author of a forthcoming book that looks at space policy, and the title is Space Cop, America's Coming War with Its Own Values. It's a book that is scheduled to be published at the beginning of next year, January 2008. From 1991 until 2000, he served as editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It's a piece in Security magazine, probably best known for its doomsday clock. I'm sure you've heard references to that in the news. He's been a journalist for a long time. He began his career in print journalism in 1961, serving as reporter or editor with the Kansas City Star. He also worked for the Chicago Daily News, the Chicago Tribune, and the Milwaukee Journal. And then from 1985 until 1991, he was at Quill. That's the magazine of the Society of Professional Journalists. He's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments from listeners are certainly welcome. All we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone who wants to join the conversation is welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So, again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Moore, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. I think that maybe it might be a good idea to step back just a bit, at least as far back as last fall, and to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about the space policy, the U.S. national space policy that was announced by the Bush administration in October. And as I said, this was the first time that it had been rewritten since the Clinton administration, which had been 10 years before. And interestingly enough, it seemed that the administration, they did announce it, although they did it in a way that made it look like they hoped nobody would notice. But in fact, it was noticed, and there certainly were some stories about this, because it did seem to represent a different direction from that of the previous policy that had been in place the 10 years before. So perhaps you could just give us the basics on the most recent now update of national space policy.
I'm going to perhaps disappoint you and your listeners because I don't think space policies mean a whole heck of a lot. The new Bush policy was very much like the Clinton policy in many, many respects. It did have a little harder edge to it, but a matter of a harder edge is a matter of interpretation. What counts is what a nation actually does. Policies are ignored or adhered to. It's almost a whimsical thing. But what does a nation actually do? And under the Bush administration, certainly we've been doing things that are, at least to me, very alarming. We're working in a very vigorous kind of way on a system of space control. And there's a long history to this, and I've got to go back briefly to the Eisenhower years in 1955, when Eisenhower established a space policy that said space should be used for peaceful purposes, period. And that was the policy in effect when Sputnik went up. Air Force officers especially, but other military officers said that policy is already out of date. We've got to achieve control of space. The Air Force Chief of Staff, a guy named Tom White, in 1958 began arguing in a very public way with his boss, saying that space control should be the goal of all Americans. Eisenhower prevailed, and he stuck to his idea that space should be used for peaceful purposes, and that has been national policy ever since. There have been some ups and downs. Certainly during the Reagan administration, we had a much more assertive space policy, but still the basic policy is no weapons in space, period. The Bush administration has had a different tone. Don Rumsfeld came into office as a champion of space control and weapons in space. He made that very plain during his years before he joined the White House or before he joined the Pentagon, and he was very active in promoting a more assertive idea about space until 9/11 happened, and he had to go on to other things. But we are right now developing the certain capabilities to control space under the National Missile Defense System. It's really very hard to find a scientist familiar with the missile defense system who believes the system would really work against missiles, but it would work against satellites of other nations. We're developing the infrastructure now for space control. And you have to watch that very carefully. What does the policy say? It's a little harder edge, but again, it's a matter of interpretation. But we are working very, very quickly on developing the infrastructure needed to actually do space control. And we're working in other areas, too. Mm-hmm.
Well, just to, in a sense, to underscore what you've said, even though, and this is something that I think that a main kind of theme in the book, in Space Cop, that will be coming out some months ahead, that even though on paper the official policy was that the United States believes in the peaceful use of space, it seems that within defense circles, people have long believed that someday there would be conflict in space, and this was something that the United States needed to prepare for and be in a position to, and for that reason, be in a position to control space. I think they would say that this was not, the intent is not hostile, the intent is defensive, but they're expecting that it's going to, sooner or later, they're expecting that it's going to be a battleground.
And then you're right about that. The idea is it's going to happen sooner or later. And here we have a little bit of a clash of worldviews. There are some people, and I'm one of them, who believe that perhaps humanity can learn a few lessons from the last century and do things a little differently in this century. Then the prevailing worldview is, well, we're not, the only thing we learn is that there's going to be war, and space is going to be the next battleground, so to speak. Back in 1982, in the General Assembly, the nations of the world, except for the United States and Israel, have voted consistently to establish a treaty in which all kinds of weapons, all kinds of space-related weapons, would be barred. Every year that comes up to a vote in the General Assembly, every year we either abstain from it or vote no for it. So the nations of the world are say they want a treaty that would prevent the weaponization of space, and we say, well, we're going to go our own way. We have a right to do what we think is best for national security. I call these people space warriors, and by the way, I've never met a space warrior yet who I did not respect. I don't think they're intent on global domination from space or anything like that, as some people on the left seem to think. But they do have a worldview that says conflict is going to happen, and we have to be ready. We have to be preemptively ready. We have to have the means to preempt anybody else, not just fight when the fight comes, but to fight before the fight comes, so to speak.
Let me take just a moment here to introduce again our guest, Mike Moore. He is currently a research fellow with the Independent Institute. It's a libertarian think tank. They have offices in San Diego and in Washington. For a number of years, between 1991 and 2000, he served as editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists and is the author of a forthcoming book that looks at space policy. The title of the book is Space Cop: America's Coming War with Its Own Values. That's now scheduled to be published in January. And we're talking about the arms race in space. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think perhaps one of the reasons that people might now be paying a little bit more attention to this, or at least the issue of the military in space, goes back to right at the beginning of the year in January when the Chinese conducted this test of what is said to be, as it's described in the coverage, an anti-satellite weapon. At least they demonstrated that what they could do was fire a rocket from the Earth and that they could hit a satellite, something that greatly concerns defense planners because of our heavy reliance both economically and militarily now on satellites. Does the Chinese test really change anything?
I think it does. It sends a very clear message. Now, the background is that the Chinese have been advocating a new space treaty, along with Russia, for many years now. The Chinese economy is booming, but as your listeners know, they have huge problems in China. They really don't want a cold war with the United States. They don't want an arms race. They want to get rich, to put it bluntly. They learned something from the Soviet Union. If you engage in a cold war with the United States, if you engage in an arms race with the United States, you're going to lose, and you're going to teeter toward bankruptcy. So the Chinese have said publicly and also quietly in diplomatic circles that they don't want an arms race, they don't want a space race, and they've been alarmed by U.S. insistence in recent years that we're going to develop a space control system, and in my view, the Chinese test in January sent a message that said, if you want an arms race, you're going to get it. And what the Chinese really want is for us to go to the negotiating table at the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva and start working on a space treaty that would ban such activities. So far we have not said we would do that. In fact, we have vetoed that idea consistently every year. But now that the Chinese have demonstrated that they may play the game, perhaps things will change. I'm not sure things will change during this administration, but perhaps in the next.
Mm-hmm. It seems that as recently as just a couple of weeks ago, there was a representative of the administration on Capitol Hill talking about space policy before the Congress and essentially saying the same thing, saying that as far as the administration is concerned, that nothing was changed. And that makes me wonder whether, now when this last space policy was announced, the political situation here in the United States was a little different. It was before last fall's election. Now the Democrats control Congress. Is there in Congress any particular desire to press on this issue, to try to push the administration a bit more in the direction of a new space treaty? And even if there was that interest, would that be likely to move the administration at all?
No, I don't think so. People in Congress tend to respond to public pressure and what's hot today, and whatever the space policy said, whatever the Chinese test did, hasn't had any real effect. People are still worried mainly about the war in Iraq and oil prices and so on and so forth. And if you ask people about space, I imagine that's about priority 2007. It's way down there. There has to be some public pressure for Congress people to get interested in this issue. And so far, there isn't. Now, it is clear that Democrats tend to be more skeptical of the idea of assertive space measures than Republicans. The Republicans tend to be gung-ho in favor of national missile defense and basing some things in space. Democrats tend to be not in favor of that. So if we get a Democratic administration, I think things will cool down a little bit. But the beneath the surface, you have a lot of people in the Air Force, in the aerospace industry, and in hardline think tanks who have been pushing this idea of space control, or space dominance, some call it, for many, many years. And they're not going to give up. They think that's the next big thing. If we can dominate space, then we can control the situation pretty much forever.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that someone on that side would make the argument in talking about the possibility of this new space treaty, the one that would reaffirm the interest of the nations of the world in peaceful, exclusively peaceful use of space. They might say something like, well, okay, so suppose we sign on to this, and the Europeans sign on to this, and maybe we could even get the Russians to sign on to this. But what if we have somebody like China, for example, that says that they don't want to play? Is there really any way that you can make certain that the group of nations who sign on, what sort of leverage do they have over anybody else who would decide that they don't want to have anything to do with it?
Well, that's an awfully good question, and no space treaty is going to work unless all the significant spacefaring nations sign on to it. And that would be that would include China and India and a few other nations. It's got to be not only a treaty that everybody agrees to. It's got to be an exceptionally tough treaty. It's got to have one that has foolproof verification measures, and it's going to have to be a treaty in which sanctions for violations are swift and severe. And I underline that point in my book. You can't have the kind of treaty that people can just opt out at will. It's got to be a truly tough one. The Chinese, of course, have taken the lead in trying to get negotiations going, so it's hard to imagine that they would back out. I advocate calling the bluff, the Chinese bluff, the Russian bluff. Everybody says they want a space treaty. Let's see if we can get there. And if we can't, well, that will tell us something. But if we can, I think the world is going to be the better for it.
Hmm. Would a treaty like this... I would assume that it would say it would place limitations on what a country could do, certainly on doing something like placing weapons in space, for example. I'm sure that the treaty would say, no, we won't do this. Would, though, such a treaty place restrictions on a nation's ability to do research and to develop programs short of deployment?
No, it shouldn't, and the key to that is highly intrusive inspections, and that would mean, in practicality, that the United States, China, and Russia, which are the principal spacefaring nations, would have to agree to an international organization, inspectors from an international organization, checking things out on the ground, and inspecting spaceships, satellites, vehicles, whatever, on the ground to make sure that they were indeed scientific or commercial satellites and not weapons of some kind. And that's a very sticky issue. The United States has said that proprietary secrets would be at risk, and the Chinese and Russians have both said they're pretty wary of such intrusive inspections. And again, we have to either decide what we're going to do. Are we going to have another arms race? Are we going to put up with the kinds of inspections that will give everybody confidence?
Mm-hmm. It seems that the United States, in agreeing to such a thing, wouldn't really have a great deal to lose other than its ability to act with complete freedom to do whatever it decides it wants to do.
You're right about that. The kind of treaty that would work would permit the United States to have all the military-related satellites it has now, which help in our ground warfare. For instance, our global positioning system, our GPS satellites, make our way of precision war possible. And if anybody tried to say, well, these are parts of weapon systems and therefore they have to go, that's not going to work. Hmm. On the other hand, the treaty would have to say other countries could develop their own communication satellites and warning satellites and observation satellites and positioning satellites and use them for ground warfare and air warfare too. There's a give and take here. We have to be willing to go to somewhat of a level playing field. The only thing we would bar is actual weapons in space or ground-based or air-based weapons that could affect satellites in space, could attack satellites in space. But otherwise, everything would be permissible.
Mm-hmm. There, I guess, it might be the big hitch, because as you said here, even though we don't have any space-based anti-satellite weapons, we are proceeding with developing a ground-based missile defense. Now, here the idea always has been that this was the kind of thing where if another nation decides to launch a ballistic missile attack against the United States, this system would be designed to try to intercept and destroy that missile before it would end up dropping its payload on the United States, or perhaps somebody who we would like to protect. But to here, I guess the concern is that it is that kind of same system, it is possible to use that as an anti-satellite weapon.
Yeah, that's the dual-purpose problem, the missile defense system. Any missile defense system has the inherent capability of attacking satellites in something we call low Earth orbit. They don't have the capability of attacking satellites in higher orbits, but certainly many, many valuable satellites are in low Earth orbit, which means they're just a few hundred miles above the surface of the Earth. And, the only thing a treaty could do would be to ban the testing of such missile defense systems against satellites. It's one thing to say a missile defense system can hit a satellite, but it's something else to be sure of that capability. And the only way you're going to be completely sure of it is to test it against satellites in space. So far, the United States has done that. In 1985, the Russians have done it, or the Soviets have done it back during the Cold War years, and now the Chinese have done it. So we have three nations that are capable of hitting satellites in low Earth orbit. We don't believe any other nation has anywhere near that capability. But more to the point, it's important to spacefaring nations, including Russia, China, and the United States, to not engage in that particular kind of warfare. Because if you smash a satellite in orbit, you create a lot of debris. And that debris then threatens the satellites of all nations in similar orbits. If you had a real conflict in space in which many satellites were smashed to bits, then you would make space virtually unusable. The thing is, the United States really doesn't want to use that kind of an anti-satellite weapon. We've made a plane that we don't want to use it. We want to develop means to disable or even destroy satellites without smashing them to bits. And we're well along that path. We're working on many separate programs now, which I call small sats, which are satellites, robotic satellites that can find and intercept satellites in orbit, come very close to them, and perhaps, if necessary, bump them into a useless orbit or snare them with a mylar net or a...
I think we've lost the guest. I don't know what happened. He just vanished. Hopefully, we can get him back here in just a second. And we'll do that. We'll get him back here in just a second. We are at our midpoint here, so this actually would be the point where I would take time to reintroduce the guest, and I'll do that. In this part of Focus 580, we're talking about the problem of the arms race in outer space, and our guest with the show is Mike Moore. He is a research fellow with the Independent Institute. That is a libertarian think tank. They have offices in San Diego and also in Washington, D.C. He is the author of a forthcoming book titled Space Cop, America's Coming War with Its Own Values, looking at the very issues that we're talking about here this morning, the militarization, weaponization of space. It's a book that's expected to be published in January 2008. From 1991 until 2000, Mike Moore served as editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. That is a peace and security magazine, best known for the Doomsday Clock, the so many minutes to midnight metaphor for global peril. I'm sure you've heard about that. It often is mentioned in the news. He's been a reporter for a long time. He began his print journalism career back in 1961, and he's been a reporter or editor with a number of newspapers, including the Kansas City Star, the Chicago Daily News, the Chicago Tribune, and the Milwaukee Journal. And then from 1985 until 1991, he was editor of Quill. That's the magazine of the Society of Professional Journalists. And we have him back. Mike, you there?
I'm here.
I'm not sure what happened there. Hopefully it had nothing to do with any satellite activity.
Well, one never knows.
We have a caller here, and I want to get to them in a second. But just to go back, I just wanted to ask one basic question. If the United States were to agree to this new space treaty, which essentially says we affirm the peaceful use of space and agree that we'll not put weapons in space and so forth, what would that mean? That the ground-based missile defense system would have to be dismantled, or would the United States only have to demonstrate the fact that it could not be used to as an anti-satellite system?
Well, that's an awfully good question, and it's probably the stickiest question there is. I can't imagine the United States is going to agree to give up its missile defense system, because missile defense sounds like such a good thing, even though it's not going to work. I think what we would have to do is negotiate a treaty that would permit any country to have such a ground-based system, as long as they were not tested against satellites.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone who was calling here. We have someone here where we are in Champaign County, and we'll get right to them. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. A subject that you return to from time to time, and it needs more attention. I applaud your efforts. I've been watching this for a fair number of years, and I've just discovered a website that I haven't seen before, Global Security Institute, farmed by late Alan Cranston, and has a lot of information, including a lot of the first documents. I wanted to mention the Vision 2020 document with all of the sort of flash garden-y looking color, though, embellishments and rather frank description of what the higher ground was necessary for, and that's global control of resources. It's actually quite frank. The one that's available under that title from the Air Force military website right now is scrubbed of all of the colorful detail, probably colorful language too, I would guess, but you can still get the document. And it was produced during the Clinton administration, so I think you would say that the military has been onto this for quite a few years, but I agree it's more dangerous now with people like the legacy of Rumsfeld. He's gone, but he was actually on the Space Commission before the election, if I recall, so that means he would have been you can correct me on that, I guess, because I can't remember. He came out of into the Defense Department after being explicitly on something called the U.S. Space Commission. Between that, implications of all that, and what about the amount of money that's being spent on this now? I think you were sort of getting at that, talking about some of the programs, but the black budget is notorious. A lot of it is pumping up the economy around Denver because of Colorado Springs being the basis for this, but I assume that there's a lot of money also being co-spent in Israel, and how much information do you know about that? How follow the money kind of question, if you would.
First, to get to Rumsfeld, he was actually chairman of the Space Commission, and the Space Commission was set up by Senator Bob Smith of New Hampshire, who was perhaps the most conservative member of Congress, of the Senate, and an ardent space warrior, and he believed the United States should take control of space immediately, if not a little bit sooner, and he's the one who set up the Space Commission and handpicked Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld was a space warrior from way back, and everybody knew that. And the Space Commission report is an interesting document to read. You can go to the web and download it. I can't give you a web address, but go to Google and plug in quote Space Commission. Unquote, and then plus text, and I think you'll find it pretty easily. You'll find in the other documents too, like Vision 2020 and the Air Force Space Command Master Plan, FY06 and beyond and that kind of thing. I would recommend the website you mentioned is now run by Jonathan Granoff, and it's a good site. But I think perhaps the most comprehensive site you could go to is the Center for Defense Information. And again, go to Google, plug in Center for Defense Information, and start exploring that site. You'll find a lot of good material on that, and it will lead you to other material. Something you have to keep in mind about military guys, they always want these dream machines. So many of them want the fantastic weapons and the Buck Rogers type things, but many of these things are scientifically not possible or not possible within a reasonable budget. For instance, Vision 2020, which you mentioned, has a painting of a space laser, I think, on the inside back cover. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Got it in front of me right now, actually.
Very dramatic. Well, the guy who did that was just an artist, and he just used his imagination, as did the Air Force Space Command guys. But in reality, there's not going to be any space lasers in my lifetime or yours. I don't know how old you are. You could be 16 years old, and there's not going to be a space laser. The technology is just too difficult. The cost is too huge. The thing we can do, and we're doing it right now, is the thing I mentioned a few minutes ago. I may have been off the air when I talked about the robotic small sats, but the kind of satellites that we can send up that can find any satellite anywhere in any orbit is the real space weapon of the future. We're testing. We have at least 5 or 6 different programs for these robotic small sats. And they've been pretty successful so far in being able to intercept the satellites of other nations or satellites of the United States. And so far they haven't done any damage to anything. Once you prove that you can find a satellite and you can come close to it, then the game's pretty well over, because then you can adapt that satellite to do any mischief you want.
Well, that's what the Chinese did, actually, is knock out one of their own satellites, right?
Well, no. The Chinese thing was a very much simpler thing. They used a kinetic kill vehicle, which simply smashed into the satellite at high speed. And that's not an easy thing, because the satellite they're aiming at is traveling at more than 17,000 miles an hour, and their own missiles traveling something close to that. And so it's a very difficult thing to hit a satellite at such speeds, but it's an old technology. We did it in 1985, and then the Soviet Union certainly did it at times. What I'm talking about is being able to find a satellite and close into it at a slow speed and get within, say, 100 yards of it or 100 feet or actually touch it. And if you can do that, then you can do things to the other satellite without smashing it to bits. You don't create debris. You could knock it into a useless orbit. You could drag it into a useless orbit with a Mylar net. You could you could spray some sort of a paint-like substance on its solar array, or if it's a spy satellite, on its optics. You can do all kinds of things to it, and we are very far ahead of anybody else in developing this technology.
Well, knocking it out is also a feat, as you say. And other than reprogramming it, I guess to give false information, I don't know what you would really want to do to get up close. The kinetic weapons, rods of gods. I think maybe did you mention that at all? This is again, the history is interesting, and there's a book called Arming the Heavens that was written in the 80s, I guess, by Jack Manna that.
Right.
That talks about the fantasy life of generals, I guess, basically, if you might want to put it that way. But what about the money? I don't know if the Center for Defense Information has enough clout to follow the money trail.
Well, the money trail is pretty ambiguous. As you mentioned, there are black programs, and I don't have any insight into what's going on in the black programs. I suspect there's quite a bit going on. A lot of the space weapons money is actually disguised in the missile defense program, but so far the dollar figures are not big. We're doing preliminary research, and I would not argue against anything on a dollar basis at this point. Now, if we really decided to build some of these dream machines that some Air Force people dream of, then you would be talking about big money. But the Air Force is in a cost-cutting mode. The war in Iraq has just wiped out a lot of programs that they wanted to see. And the Air Force isn't, their top Air Force officers are not eager to spend a lot of money for these kind of science fiction type programs when they don't have enough money to pay for new fighters and that kind of thing. The dollar issue is not the big thing. The policy issue is, as long as we say that we advocate a policy of space control and space dominance, we're going to incite other nations to say, well, the Americans can do anything they want, apparently, and technologically speaking, so we'd better try to do what we can to counter their new forces. That's how arms races began. You know, the action-reaction dynamic is an important one.
I agree. If I might have one more point, which is we don't, black budgets are exactly that. We don't know what is being spent. It's not as, I don't see how one can categorically say they know what's going on. The other thing is the motive. You already sort of dismissed the idea of world dominance, but again, I commend people's attention to some of the language in the original Vision 2020, which is very explicit in saying that this is for control of resources. It's rather frank. That's why they've scrubbed it, I guess. Thank you.
Well, I should say Vision 2020 is not a statement of national policy. It's kind of a wishful thinking of space warriors. And national policy is not quite that aggressive yet.
Yeah. And I guess before I want to mention for people, if you decide to go on the web and go looking for information on this, and if you just put in Vision 2020, you'll get something else entirely different. What you want is Joint Vision 2020.
Oh, Joint Vision 2020. And there's something called Space Command plus Vision 2020, and you'll get a Space Command Vision 2020 document.
Okay. And other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have about 10 minutes or so left in this part of Focus 580. In this first hour, let me again introduce the guest, Mike Moore. He's a research fellow with the Independent Institute, that is a libertarian think tank. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Space Cop, America's Coming War with Its Own Values, will be published or is expected to be published in January of 2008. He also served for a number of years as the editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and before that was a journalist and worked for a number of papers, including the Daily News and the Chicago Tribune and the Milwaukee Journal. Again, questions are welcome. You can give us a call. As you mentioned and the caller mentioned, just to go back for a second, people will think back to the presidency of Ronald Reagan and his proposal for the Strategic Defense Initiative, this thing that came to be commonly called Star Wars, and the number of rather fanciful proposals for space-based weapons, not only weapons that would work against other satellites, it would work against ballistic missiles, would possibly be used against targets on the ground. And as you said, that there were a couple of big problems. One was that there were enormous technical issues to be dealt with if you were going to do this, and that these projects were incredibly expensive. But having said that, money was spent on research and development of some of these kinds of ideas. Did anything come of any of that?
Well, in my view, not much. but there are space warriors who will say, well, we learned a lot, and the money was well spent. And when they say we learned a lot, their fantasies are kicking in again. I've met a lot of people in closed-door meetings. I was on a couple of national task forces a few years ago, and behind closed doors, you don't find many people who think we're going to have space-based weapons or that they're even desirable. Again, the name of the game is the ability to knock out the satellites of other nations, and the best way to do that is from the ground or with satellites that are search and destroy satellites that are launched from the ground, and then find the satellites you want to hit and hit them. But the idea of basing things in space is just alarming in that it would be very, very costly. Even space warriors admit that in private. And also it would alarm the whole world for weapons to be up there. It's somehow less alarming to be sending satellites or search and destroy satellites up from the ground. The thing we have to remember is that when space warriors talk about space control, they talk about the ability to control space in a time of conflict. They say time and time again that space control measures would not be used in times of peace. Nobody should worry about it. My argument is that if you develop and test and deploy a space control capability, then it can be used at any time at a time of your own choosing. And that's got to alarm other nations. We can say that we would do this only in a time of conflict, but how can other nations be sure of that? Political science realists talk about capabilities. They don't talk too much about intentions. They say, look at the capabilities of other states. Now, if China said, we are going to have a capability to control space in a time of conflict by 2020, we would go nuts over here. We would say that's an aggressive act. It violates our sovereignty, and we'd better get on the ball and beat them to it. If Russia said that, we would do the same thing. Why should other countries sit back and say, well, let's let the United States do it? They're not. Again, an arms race is in the offing if we don't change our policy.
Other questions or comments are welcome in the time that remains here. If you'd like to give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, just again to talk a little bit more about what's happening with the United States' effort to develop anti-satellite kind of weapons. We've talked about the fact that the United States, along with Russia and China, now have demonstrated the capability of launching a missile from the Earth, hitting a satellite, and destroying it, just blowing it to pieces. And
right.
That's really not desirable. There's enough junk floating around in space as it is. We really don't want to do that. So for that reason, as you have explained, the more sophisticated way, the more desirable way to do it would be to disable the satellite without smashing it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of ways that we're pursuing to try to do that. What's the timeline on those kinds of programs, and has anybody said anything about when they would think that one of these kinds of things, whether it would mean bumping the satellite or dragging it out of orbit or spraying paint over its visual sensors or whatever you're going to do, when something like that actually might be even close to operational?
Well, some of these are pretty close right now,
mm-hmm.
but they're described as scientific programs. One is called XSS for Experimental Satellite System. Another is called DART, D-A-R-T, or Demonstrator to Test Future Autonomous Rendezvous Technologies in Orbit. One is called MITEX, that's M-I-T-E-X, or Microsatellite Technology Experiment. One is called ANGELS, or Autonomous Nanosatellite Guardian for Evaluating Local Space. And another is called Orbital Express Space Operations Architecture Program. And truly, if your listeners want to get on the Internet and look some of these things up, they'll be surprised. Plug in small sats or plug in robotic satellites and see what happens. And you'll be led in different ways, or go to the Center for Defense Information and start there. But we're testing these things right now. Now, we're not testing them in a weapons mold, but again, the trick here is to develop a system that can actually get close to another satellite. And once you do that, then what you do is really a piece of cake. I mean, you can get close and you can service a satellite, or you can blow it up. or I shouldn't say blow it up, but bump it. You can do any number of things once you can get close to it. But space is a very big place, and the idea is you've got to get close.
We have a caller here. Before we find ourselves out of time, let's get to them in Kankakee. This would be line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Your caller is interested in the implications in American constitutional law and in international law of space-based weapons. How does the American Constitution and international law speak to this question? Thank you.
All right. There is an existing space treaty now,
right.
Is there not?
There's a space treaty that was led by the United States, initiated by Eisenhower, really, called the Outer Space Treaty in 1967, right. And it prohibits weapons of mass destruction in space. Back then, all they were concerned about were nuclear weapons. Nobody was thinking about precision weapons in space. But it doesn't prohibit anything else, simply weapons of mass destruction in space. What we're talking about now is a treaty that would permit, that would prohibit any kind of weapon in space, not just weapons of mass destruction, but precision weapons like lasers, and would prohibit ground-based or air-based weapons that could strike targets in space or strike satellites in space. And now that's a very different kind of thing than we have today. The 1967 treaty declared space to be the province of all mankind, and we have to remember that. If it's the province of all mankind, should any nation, United States, Russia, China, or any nation, have the capability to control it in a time of conflict? Because if you have the ability to control it in a time of conflict, you can do it at any time, at least in theory.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds then as if that there does international law at all address the use of space?
Oh, in many ways. It addresses the use of space in regard to scientific satellites and commercial satellites, mainly it's kind of a traffic management sort of outlook. But international law does not address weapons in space except for weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the callers can question about U.S. law and the Constitution, I guess I would imagine that it wouldn't have much to say about space at all.
No, the Constitution is kind of an overall guide, and it says the president is commander chief, and Congress can declare war, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Congress can always cut off funds for certain military programs it doesn't like, and that's something that I'd like to see in the future, that we'd be more assertive in Congress about cutting off programs that might lead towards space weaponization of some kind.
Hmm. Well, you've talked about the fact that now for, I think, a couple of decades, there has been discussion about the need for a new treaty to prevent an arms race in space. And this is something that the United States has blocked. And I would assume that there are only a handful of nations here that have demonstrated anti-satellite capability, but there are a lot of countries that have satellites who
right.
would be very interested, I'm sure, in seeing that this not happen. As far as the rest of the world is concerned, is there much of an organized movement, particularly I would guess here we'd be talking about industrialized countries, who have communication satellites, who would be concerned about their security?
I think it's safe to say that every spacefaring nation in the world is troubled by the idea that space should be weaponized in some way, or that there might be conflict in space that might create debris in space. The only two countries that have said they're not in favor of a new treaty are the United States and Israel. And that's been consistent. From time to time, Micronesia has voted against considering such a treaty, too. But it's kind of a protectorate of the United States. The United States and Israel have said, in effect, we want to keep all of our options open, including the weaponization of space. All other countries are on record as saying they do not favor that. They want a new treaty. Now, many of these countries may or may not be sincere. We don't know that. We won't know it unless we agree to sit down and start negotiating.
It seems highly unlikely now for the rest of the Bush administration that there'll be a change of policy on this. I find it difficult to imagine that they're going to change their mind.
I agree.
So I guess I would expect that the only way that this was that we would see a significant change in U.S. space policy would be if we had a change of administration. And I don't believe that I have heard anybody, Republican or Democrat, in any of the conversations so far involving candidates, say anything about space policy, and I could have missed it. Maybe you have, because this is something that is a major focus of yours. Is this, as far as you know, something that all of those people who are interested in running for president on either side of the aisle are, is anybody talking about this?
Well, only Dennis Kucinich, and of course, Dennis Kucinich does not have a big following, but otherwise it isn't an issue for anybody.
Would you anticipate that somehow it would become an issue, or do you think that there'll be so many other things going in the campaign that it's likely that this would be, I'm sure there will be plenty of national security issues on the agenda, high up on the agenda, but this one, would you expect this to get much discussion?
I think it will get about zero discussion.
Would they? All right. Then let us say, though, we do have a change of administration, and not to be partisan here, but you know, let us say that we have a Democrat in the White House. Would you expect that the space policy as a result would change?
Well, that's possible, but I have to say that the Clinton administration was not a good example. It was not favorable to the space warrior point of view, but then Clinton was a little gutless and really going after it, and we would have to have a president who had some real guts, because the aerospace lobby and a lot of guys in the Air Force are really keen on promoting this. And for a president to take him on is a risky thing.
Well, at that point, we're going to have to stop. I'm sure that, as the earlier caller said, it is something that we like to check in on from time to time, so I'm sure it's something we'll come back to again in the future. But in the meantime, there is a lot of information on the web. If you have access, you can look for some of the things we've talked about. And then also, now we're expecting in January, our guest's book will be published, Space Cop, America's Coming War with Its Own Values. That right now is what you're looking at, January of 2008? And what's the publisher?
It's the Independent Institute.
By the Independent Institute. He is indeed, Mike Moore, our guest, is indeed a research fellow with the Independent Institute. It is a libertarian think tank there based in San Diego and in Washington. He's also a former editor of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And Mr. Moore, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.